Welcome to the Manufacturing Executive Podcast, where we explore the strategies and experiences that are driving mid-sized manufacturers forward. Here, you'll discover new insights from passionate manufacturing leaders who have compelling stories to share about their successes and struggles. And you'll learn from B2B sales and marketing experts about how to apply actionable business development strategies inside your business. Let's get into the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Manufacturing Executive Podcast. I'm Joe Sullivan, your host and a co-founder of the industrial marketing agency Gorilla 76, where we help B2B manufacturers grow through revenue-focused marketing programs. Where do new product ideas come from? Do they stem from the needs of your customers and your prospects? Or do they come from what you think your prospects and your customers might need? In today's conversation, my guest will talk about how to drive new product blueprinting through real customer insights. Let me introduce him. Dan Adams founded the AIM Institute in 2005, a training and software company that helps B2B companies drive organic growth. Dan is the author of the books Business Builders, How to Become an Admired and Trusted Corporate Leader, and New Product Blueprinting, as well as the weekly blog Awkward Realities and video series B2B Organic Growth. Dan is a chemical engineer with numerous patents and listing in the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Dan has trained tens of thousands of B2B professionals globally in the front end of innovation and helps leaders of large global B2B companies drive profitable, sustainable, organic growth. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me with you here, Joe.
Hall of Fame, huh? National Inventors Hall of Fame. That's pretty cool. I did not have anybody on the show who has been able to put that in their bio.
Yeah, they have the corporate section for this. It was actually one of the most fun times in my entire career. I actually had this crazy idea. I would schedule technical breakthroughs every Friday afternoon, which is pretty silly. But I was in marketing at the time. I wrapped up my goggles and my lab coat. Every Friday afternoon, I'd go over, I'd order different chemicals. I was in the chemical industry. And then once it actually worked, and we ended up selling a product, tens of millions of dollars, I told people I used the J. Paul Getty formula of success: rise early, work hard, strike oil. So there, in other words, just a little bit of dumb luck was involved in the whole thing.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Well, Dan, it's really good to have you here. We've had a couple of really good conversations recently, and I'm excited to get into this today. But before we really dive into the meat of the conversation, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your professional journey, and how AIM Institute came to be?
You betcha, Joe. I was born at an early age. Oh, you wanted the short version. So my background's chemical engineering, and I actually started in manufacturing. I used to work the midnight shift and swing shift and all kinds of stuff in a chemical plant. This was a long time ago. This is back in the 70s. But then I did a lot of different things within the chemical industry, within the chemical company I was in, strategy, marketing, technical. But the thing I just loved was product development. And I was overseeing a bunch of teams, and we kept trying different things to see if we could boost our success rate. And it turns out, if you figure out what the customers want before you develop your new product, it actually works better. Who knew, right? But we developed a lot of methods to help do that. So at one point in time, this would have been 2004, I went to my boss and asked him to get me fired if he could, because they had big severance packages back then. It's like a year-long severance package. And so you just can't raise your hand and say, I quit. You got to get fired. So that's a whole nother story. But finally, I got fired. It wasn't quite as easy. I was happy it wasn't quite as easy as I thought it would be. And then I started up the AIM Institute in 2005, as you said earlier.
Great. And tell us just a little bit about AIM.
We're basically a training company. If you think about new product development, you can think of three stages. The front end, often called the fuzzy front end, what the heck do these customers want? Then there's a development stage. We go into the lab and we push back the frontiers of modern science. And then there's the launch phase. We work exclusively in that front end. We only do training. We don't do it for them. And we only work for B2B companies, the vast, vast majority of whom are manufacturing companies. About 70% of our work historically has been with Fortune 500. But when COVID hit, we had to completely change our business model. I don't know if people are able to see where I'm sitting, but I'm in an easy chair now. Somebody asked me if I was going to read them a bedtime story the other day. But it used to be, before COVID, I'd have to go out traveling all around the world. One year I was in Shanghai 7 different times. But now we had to change our business model. It's more virtual. So we can train any size company, basically. But it's still pretty much focused on manufacturers, training, product development in the front end, figuring out customer needs.
Love it. Well, that's great. We're going to talk a whole bunch about one of the things you mentioned there, which in a joking way, but man, is it true, like understanding what your customer actually wants and needs before you actually go down the product development route. It just reminds me of my world as a marketing guy. Is for you, it's product development. For me, it's like going to market with a message for an audience and taking the time to invest in creating content and building a website to support that message and all the things that come along with marketing. And I think so many companies, whether it's on the product development side or just their go-to-market strategy side, they're just going on assumptions, what they think their audience wants or cares about. And to actually do the direct customer research to get qualitative and quantitative insights that support what you assume to be true, but also probably show you things you didn't realize might be true. All of those things are just so valuable. And I think too many companies look at it as like, yeah, that would be nice, but we got to go. And you know, there's a balance there, right? Like you can't wait till everything's perfect, but you got to go in there with some real insights that your strategy, whether it's marketing or product development or whatever it is rooted in. So I think we're well aligned on kind of the philosophy there. I'm excited to talk about it today.
It's really strange the time we're in. I believe in 20 or 30 years, people will look back and be absolutely astounded of the poor practices that are being done, especially in B2B, new product development. I do a micro blog called Awkward Realities, and my definition is it's something you're doing today that won't make sense later. And I remember in manufacturing, a lot of your guests will remember Dr. Deming. We used to have inspectors at the end of the line. Then he taught us statistical process control. We used to tell our salespeople to the ABC method, always be closing. Then we taught them consultants and selling. We used to do payback period. Now we do discounted cash flow. Well, of all those things, here's the silliest one. We can go and have really intelligent conversations with our B2B customers and understand exactly what they want. But instead, almost all companies, and I'm talking about some enormous multi-billion dollar companies here. Picture a catapult, like a medieval catapult. You're going to love the next one. Whoosh. We're firing products at our customers instead of finding out what they want first. Someday we'll look back and be really amazed or cringe at how we do things today.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I'm excited to actually go check out your blog because you've mentioned a few that are great examples of what changes. And yeah, I suppose if we just keep doing what we think our customers want, it probably really inhibits innovation. And ultimately, you're just not delivering against what the real needs are out there.
Yeah. We need to find out what customers want in a rather rigorous fashion. I think it was Ken Barksdale, the head of Netscape, said, if we have data, let's use it. If we have opinions, let's use mine. And so everybody's got their opinion, but we need to actually be a little more rigorous about what the customers actually want. And we can do that in B2B. It's hard to do in B2C, but in B2B, it's much easier to do, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That was one question I had queued up for you. Like, you've made a very specific decision, as has my company as a marketing agency, to focus specifically in the B2B world. Like, what drove that decision? What is it about B2B buying environments and product development, I guess, environments that is appealing to you?
The B2B customer can tell you a lot more and you can engage them more deeply. Here's an example. Let's say, Joe, you and I work for a company, we make hose. Now, on one day, we're going to go out and talk to homeowners about their garden hose. On another day, we're going to go talk to a Caterpillar mechanical engineer about her hydraulic hose, okay? Now, let's think about the depth of those conversations. We know they'll be different, but why? There's really 5 reasons, I believe. The first reason is that mechanical engineer has much more knowledge. She spent all those years in school, training on the job, really focused on this. How much knowledge does the homeowner have about the garden hose? Not much. They run over the lawnmower and get upset. The second is interest. The engineer, Caterpillar, is interested because we could make that engineer a hero by delivering great innovation to the next earth-moving equipment or whatever. How interested are end consumers? Well, here's a clue. You got to pay them to come to your focus group.
There you go.
Yep. Next one's objectivity. When you get to the B2B, they have to be more rational because they're being held accountable. There's team decision made, multiple decision makers. There's policies to follow. So we know consumers are pretty fickle on the other hand. And then foresight. The B2B customer can tell you what they want before they see a prototype. Consumers, if I ask you, what do you want in a video game? What do you want in a snack food? What do you want in a men's suit? You're going to say, well, let me play with it. Let me try it on. Let me, you know, whatever. Whereas in the case of B2B, they'll tell you they're in business to make money. Make my line go faster, cut down my defects, cut down my labor costs, help me make my product brighter and shinier. So all those things are there. And then the last one is in many, not all, many, many B2B situations, you have a concentrated industry. What I mean by that is you have a relatively few number of customers. And so you can engage them. And if you do the interviews right, by the time you're ready to sell, they're ready to buy because they're engaged. And you couldn't do that with a million consumers. So there's enormous benefits in B2B, but I don't know that anybody else, at least in the innovation space, is really customizing their approach as we are. But we just think it's fantastic to be able to work with B2B clients.
Yeah, you did a really nice job summarizing that. Obviously, you've thought about that a lot before and I've talked about it a lot. Because I think sometimes I make comparisons to selling a $800,000 industrial oven or $1 million piece of food packaging equipment that's the size of my house to the closest equivalent is consumer level is like you buying a new car or a computer right. or something where it's like, it's a big decision. There are consequences to making the wrong decision. You're really invested in it. But I think even there, what's missing is some of the things you talked about, like existing knowledge, right? Like an engineer who is a plant engineer who is on the buying committee and maybe one of the most influential people in buying a large CapEx piece of machinery that the company's going to have to live with for the next decade. They're knowledgeable. They're experts in that thing they're buying already. And you, the one selling it, are maybe a little more knowledgeable, but you're able to consult them and help get them up to speed. Versus when I'm buying a car, I mean, frankly, I am not a car guy, right? Like, but I need a right. car to drive. And so I think there are a lot of good points there about how invested the B2B buyer, especially in more complex sales, really is and how that changes. So I think there's a lot of the same reasons why I've really liked working in this B2B manufacturing space for basically the last decade and a half.
Yeah. There's another benefit that's a little bit harder to see, but if you're a B2C manufacturer, you're making consumer goods, you're a consumer yourself. So when Steve Jobs and Apple were working on the iPod, well, he had 400 engineers, but they were consumers. So it wasn't that unfamiliar what they're going into. But if my company makes pigment and it gets sold to a paper mill, I don't really know their job to be done. I don't understand their world. So the delta between what I could learn from a business B2B customer and what I know is enormous compared to B2C. I tell people there are all these wonderful advantages of B2B, but an advantage is no advantage unless you take advantage of it. And very, very few B2B manufacturers are taking advantage of their B2B advantages today.
Great transition to where I think I want to go next. I know your company's done some research on 12 voice of customer skills. And maybe define that term voice of customer, VOC, just for people who aren't listening or hear VOCs and think about emissions into the environment. And
yeah, right.
We're talking about a different VOC here. Tell us what voice of customer is all about. And then I'd love for you to tell us what you learned from the research on some of those critical VOC skills.
So voice of customer is making sure we understand, you know, what the customer's real needs are. Now, it's been applied in so many ways. The term is actually about 30 years old now. Abby Griffin started it. In our space, we generally apply it to innovation. There's also, you could apply it to other sales calls and so forth, but let's maybe for our conversation restrict it to voice of customer so I understand what their needs are so that I can develop a product or a service that meets those needs. We did research 2 years ago, and what we did was ask about 12 different voice of customer skills. Some of those were, are you getting the right people to interview? But a lot of them were about the types of questions you asked. Did you probe for meaning, for depth? Did you get all the needs? Did you prioritize them? So picture there's 12 of those needs, okay? And then we asked people to rate their own competency. we graded the scale. 5 is barely acceptable. Anything worse than that, you're... And some graded themselves worse than barely acceptable. A 10 is like, man, I can't get any better. Okay. So we had a lot of input on all 12 skills on how good people thought they were, how competent they were. But then we also asked them, hey, by the way, when you're doing new product development and you're on a project team, what is your average hit rate? And we had some people saying, man, when I'm on a team, we are usually successful. Some were a little above average, some were average, some a little below. Some were like, it's rarely successful. Want me on your team? Okay. So we got all this data. We had, over 300 responses. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's a lot we learned, but the thing we were really looking for is this. Of the 12 voice of customer skills, which one most strongly differentiates the winners from the losers when it comes to new product development, right? I mean, that would be good to know. It's not proven causation, but boy, it's some real strong hints on correlation here. So the one that just blew away all the rest of these was the voice of customer skill called prioritize customer needs. So every one of them was a differentiator. In other words, every one of the 12 skills were differentiating between winning and losing at new product development. But this one was by far the biggest gap. So what do we mean by prioritize? So if you don't mind, hold that thought for a moment. And then let me tell you what I think B2B companies should do when it comes to voice of customer, okay? And we'll come back to that research in a minute. So what we train people in our process called new product blueprinting is go out and do 2 rounds of interviews, a qualitative one called discovery, and then a quantitative one called preference. So let's imagine this, Joe, you and I work for a company that makes paint ingredients, okay? So we go out, we call in Sherwin-Williams, later on we call in PPG, later on we call in AkzoNobel. We're calling on all these paint companies. And we're doing discovery, which is divergent. And we're simply asking, what other problems are you having? Oh, we need better scrub resistance. What else? Better fade resistance. Now, every time we ask that, we're probing deeply to understand what they want and why they want it and when they want it. And in our methodology, we actually project sticky notes up on a screen or we show it in a Zoom or Teams call. Okay. That's discovery. That's great for uncovering all the needs, but we have no idea which one they really want us to work on. I mean, by the time we're done interviewing half a dozen paint companies, we've got dozens and dozens of these. If we were to pick some to work on, we'd be guessing. Okay. So the next step is the one that's really critical. And this is the prioritize step. And this is the one almost everybody omits. We go back to those customers again, and we ask them 2 questions for maybe a dozen of the outcomes. Hey, for fade resistance, how important is that to you on a scale of 1 to 10? And how satisfied are you with the fade resistance you get now? And then we go on to the next one. For scrub resistance, how important? How satisfied? So we do that for all of them, okay? Now we've got some really interesting data. We know for 10 outcomes, how important and how satisfied. Now, which ones are we going to work on? Well, we're going to work on the ones that score high in importance and low in current satisfaction, because that's the only thing they might pay us a premium for. If it's not important, then they're not going to pay a premium for it. If they're already getting it, they're already satisfied, they're not going to pay a premium. So it's only the ones that are important that are not being satisfied. Even before I started the company, I hooked up a very simple formula called market satisfaction gap. It's basically the importance times, parentheses here, 10 minus the satisfaction. So the higher the importance and the lower the satisfaction, the higher the number. And we've done this with over 1,000 teams around the world. And what we find is if you get a gap of around 30% or more, the market is eager to see your work on it. So I go back to that. If we have data, let's use it. When our clients are successful, they stop going into the development stage unless they have hard data, unfiltered, unbiased, direct from the customer. If you don't do that, you're going to have problems. So let's come back to the research that I mentioned. That's the prioritize step. This is the thing that blows away everything else. So if you don't get that quantitative thing, you can still do some qualitative and you might get a little better, But why would you not go back and get the quantitative and know for sure what your market really wants? So that's the methodology.
Yeah, that's really smart. It makes a ton of sense. I'm just kind of curious, what are some of the other things? I don't need a comprehensive list, but what are some of the other skills that you guys researched in that work you did?
There's quite a few of them here. Can you get the interviews? Can you get the right interviewees? And this one's funny. Can you impress the customers while you're doing the interview? If you're in a concentrated market, that's kind of important. Can you get all their needs? That would be discovery. Can you probe for meaning? Why do you want it? Can you probe for value? What's it do for you? Get the quantitative. Also, there's some other things like, are you debriefing well after the interview? Can you develop a business case based upon this? So those are some of the other skills that are the voice of customer skills. But the one that just really rang the bell was prioritized. In fact, I don't remember all this, but it's kind of interesting. I did not expect this. Well, the one that the untrained wanted to fix the most was prioritized. The one that improved the most of training was prioritized. It was really fascinating. There were about five things where prioritized market needs came out at the very top of the list. I always felt it was important. I've been telling anybody who'd listen, you need to do quantitative interviews, but it just came screaming out at us, the data.
Wow. Yeah, well, there's some validation for you. I mean, that's why you go do research, right?
Yeah, you learn.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, let's take a quick break here. I want to let a couple of our strategists at Guerrilla 76 tell you about something pretty cool that we're doing right now for marketing folks in the manufacturing sector. Peyton and Brendan, take it away.
So I'm Peyton Warren.
And I'm Brendan Forrest.
Twice a month, we host a live event called Industrial Marketing Live.
Right now, we have a group of 50 plus industrial marketers from a variety of manufacturing organizations that meet up digitally to learn, ask questions, network, and get smarter.
Every session has a designated topic, and one of our team members at Guerrilla 76 opens up by teaching for the first half hour or so. Topics have included how to do a better manufacturing webinar, getting started with paid social on LinkedIn, how to optimize your website for conversions, creating amazing video content, and so much more.
After we break it down, we open it up to Q&A so we can help you apply all of this in your own businesses.
This is pure value, no cost, no strings attached, no product or service pitches, just a 100% unadulterated learning experience.
And on top of these live sessions, we've also opened up a Slack channel where attendees bounce ideas off each other and learn together between sessions.
We're building a true community of manufacturing marketing professionals here. So if you or someone at your company has the word marketing in his or her job title, please consider telling them about it. They can visit industrialmarketinglive.com to register.
We'd love to see you there.
So Dan, I've had a few people on this show. In fact, I meant to ask you, if another Ohio guy, VOC expert named Dave Loomis. Do you know Dave?
Oh my goodness. Dave used to work for us. He was our senior VP.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know.
Yeah, for a number of years. Dave's great. If anybody is listening and you have a chance to work with Dave, definitely do so. And he is so strong in B2B marketing. Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
Yeah, very strong.
Tremendous. Yeah.
He's a two-time guest on this show, actually.
Oh, great. Excellent.
We talked about, I forgot how we were introduced. I think it was one of my past employees who knew Dave from a previous job or something. But He came in and talked a lot about an overview of VOC and the importance and how you do it. And then came back on, I don't know, maybe 6-12 months ago. I know he has a book coming out, or maybe came out.
It came out. Mm-hmm.
And we talked a little bit about that. But one of the things I talked to him about, and I'm curious to hear your take on it too, because like we do at Guerrilla, my agency, we're a marketing agency. We're not product development, like your area of consulting expertise, but we are huge advocates of direct customer research. So for us, as I kind of hinted at earlier, before we develop messaging, before we make decisions about what content to invest in, like we want to validate what we think what their customers actually care about before we start talking to them all about it and solutions or problems that they may not even have, but our client thinks are important to them. So I love the prioritization. I think that's really important. But I guess the question I was going to ask you, because sometimes we get pushback. Our clients are like, I know you want to do that. It feels a little fluffy. Like, why don't we just move on to making the content and like whatever, working on the website, launching some campaigns. And we push back real hard on that because, I mean, for a lot of the reasons we talk about, but I'm curious if you see that kind of resistance sometimes to investing in the direct customer research, or if that's not as much of a hurdle in your world.
Well, maybe not as much, because when we get engaged, they want to develop a new product. So they know, well, yeah, of course, not everybody engages us and they keep doing it the old way with the catapult.
Sure,
right?
Yeah, but, yeah. You're talking to the people who do actually care about getting it right. So I suppose like you filtered out maybe some who don't anyway, but...
Yeah, but you raise a really good point here, Joe, because even the ones who come to us and say, oh, I really need this research to do a better job of developing the right product, they don't notice some other benefit that is incredibly powerful that we often share with them, and that is the marketing aspect. So let's go back to our example. We go in the coatings industry, a certain area, we do all this research, we get market satisfaction gaps. You and I now have an amazing research report. And this research becomes collateral for our salespeople to use. It's fantastic for search engine optimization. So now we have a marketing vehicle because we've learned something that each of those individual paint companies didn't know. We've taken all that information, and it's really important to make it quantified, not just qualitative. But now we've got data nobody else has. No, those people... Our salespeople now are going to take those research reports. We're going to promote those. We're going to have mailings, emailings. People are going to be downloading our research report. It's an excellent way of not only developing the right product, but remember those three stages, front end, development, launch. It's fantastic when you launch your product and promote it because you have research. So that's often missed, but that's a really powerful side benefit of doing voice of customer work.
Really smart. So much of this is common sense if you think about it. Like, why would we not want to know what actually matters to the people that we need to reach? We have an audience. We want to sell them product. Wouldn't you want to know everything you can about what's inside their brains, what their buying process looks like, what their actual problems are? It's kind of common sense, but I think a lot of companies just don't do it.
They don't do it. And some of your clients may have a stage gate process. Most large manufacturers do a stage gate process. You know, I'm going to develop a new product and get the front end. A lot of times they won't have three stages. They'll have four or five or six or something. Okay. And when you look at those stage gate processes, they usually have a little thing at the left called idea generation, a little light bulb. Okay. If you want to have a little fun, ask them, say, oh, I see your new product development starts with idea generation. Whose idea is that? Is it your idea? Or is it your customers? Now, in 95% of the case, what you're going to hear is, well, it's our idea. Oh, really? Yeah, it's something we think customers want. Okay, great. What do you do next? Oh, and then we validate it, and we develop it, we do all this. And then, oh, well, wait a minute, before you finish that, let me ask you, when do you actually try to understand what the market wants? And they go, well, let's see. I guess it's when we launch it, we see if anybody buys it. Okay, so let me see if I got this right. You're starting, this is painful, isn't it?
Yeah,
let me see if I got this right.
I'm cringing as you speak.
Yeah, yeah. You're starting with your solution and you're ending with the market needs. Yeah. Well, what if we got a little crazy? What if we have a little diagram, it kind of moves around like this. What if we started with the market needs and ended with the solution? Again, someday people are going to go, wait a minute, were they really doing that? You got to be kidding me. But that's what we're doing. It's an awkward reality.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm being reminded of an episode I did not long ago with Adam Keating, who is the CEO of a company called CoLab, which is sort of a play on collaboration. But
yeah,
they've developed a collaboration software for design engineers in the product development process. Amazing company, phenomenal leadership. Some of the best marketers I've ever known are working inside that company, leading them. Oh. But anyway, that's kind of beside the point. I wasn't paid to promote them just now. I just can't help but to do so. But my conversation with Adam was really interesting because they conducted a research report a year or so ago across I'm looking at my notes here, it was 250 global engineering leaders, and they documented a report titled Quantifying the Impact of Design Review Methods on New Product Development. And it was a research report to understand the design engineering leaders that they needed to reach for their own sake, but it became a publicly published report. Ton of value in there. I've kind of glanced through it and read the executive summary, et cetera. But to me, this was a perfect example of it's one way to do customer research, right? Is to maybe not be direct VOC. It was, I think, a little more quantitative maybe. But one thing that I think he said as he talked about that, that I think is really important too, is they go do a research project like that to better understand at scale what the people they need to reach and influence actually care about, what matters to them, and what their daily job looks like and the problems they're trying to actually solve. But then they take it and they say, okay, now what are we going to do? Because I think maybe one of the mistakes, or maybe the assumptions, that's the wrong assumptions that's made by people who go do some form of customer research, is now we're going to give them exactly what things they asked for. And what do you wind up with? A Frankenstein product. You've taken advice from every single person. You're reacting to that. And I think the way he explained it, if I'm remembering correctly, was you take those insights and you use them to inform the decisions about the products that you're going to make, because you're the expert in product development, but now you're making informed decisions in response to what the market's telling you. So I don't know if that makes sense, but like that to me was a really important point, I thought.
I think there's two things there that are entwined in what you just said that are very important. The first thing is, when you ask the customers what they want, there's three things that can come out of their mouth: outcome, solution, or background. Background is just stuff, okay? But the solution is how to deliver an outcome. The outcome is what they want. Yeah. So we're very careful in our training. We strongly encourage our clients to stay out of solution space and only stay in outcome space. The outcome space is where your customers are expert. The solution space is what you want to do later on. You don't want to mess up your intellectual property. And besides, if you just chase these solutions, as you said, who knows if it's the right one? There may be a better solution if you understand the underlying outcome. So the first thing is, in the discovery and preference interviews, it's all about outcomes, never about solutions, okay? But the second thing you mentioned is also important. You can have different people telling you different things. So when you go into a project, you need to identify a market segment. And our definition of a market segment is a cluster of customers with similar needs. So if you're going to paint producers, you'd be talking about the same sort of paint they were producing. In theory, they have the same needs because they're selling the same product and competing with each other. So that's your market segment. But then within the company, when you talk to the Sherwin-Williams operations person, they want faster line speed. The marketing person wants higher gloss levels, and they don't agree. So it's really critical in the preference interviews to get all of those decision makers and influencers. And on average, there's some research that says there's 4.5 in a B2B company. I mean, depends how the big company is, okay? But you got to get all those decision makers and influencers in a room. I mean, you say, how important is scrub resistance? And the operation guy goes, it's a 3. It's not important at all. And the marketing guy goes, it's a 9. I need that. My customers want it. We need to let them debate it and then say, from the standpoint of your entire company, how important is, and then you get that number. Now, if you do that, if you're disciplined on the market segment and you make sure you get the main decision-making process embodied in your quantitative interviews, now you're going to have some really good data, and it's all going to be about desired outcomes, and you can trust that. Then you start working on your solutions once you know what the outcomes are.
Yeah, that was all really well said. I like thinking about it simply as, let the customer tell you the outcome they want because you're the solution expert. I mean, it's like the famous Henry Ford quote, right? If I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have told me they wanted faster horses, right? And then where would we be? So yeah, well said. Well, Dan, that segment was really great there. One thing I had intended to ask you about was, I heard you talk about commercial versus technical risk. What's that all about?
Commercial risk is, do I really understand what my customers want? What's the right priority? And also how they value that. Are they going to be willing to pay for that? Technical risk is, once I set my specifications for what I want to create in my new product, can I actually do it? Can I actually achieve my design objectives? Because sometimes the laws of science just don't let us go where we want to go, right? What a lot of people do that gets confusing for them, they work those in parallel. And at face value, it's, do things in parallel. It makes a lot of sense. But you shouldn't. What you should do is pick a market segment. And then in the front end, before you ever go into the lab, You want to nail that commercial risk. You want to drive out almost all the commercial risk, have that market satisfaction gap with a really, really clear picture of what those desired outcomes are. Then when you enter the development stage and start going into the lab, your only question is, can I achieve this or not? And some people say, well, can I go in the lab a little bit in the front end? Well, why would you work on stuff until you know what the market wants? So get that commercial risk nailed down first, then in the development stage, go up your technical. And our most successful clients lay this discipline on themselves. They no longer allow any significant project to go into development unless they have quantified, unbiased, unfiltered data from the customer on what the market does and does not want. It's usually a market satisfaction gap, basically. So that would be my advice. If you want to stop wasting a lot of resources, don't go in the lab until you nail the commercial risk first.
Yeah, love it. That's such smart advice. And again, like so much of this feels like common sense, but it's just not. People don't think that way necessarily. And they need somebody like you who is in this world to say, here's why this matters. Here's how you need to do it. So wow. Well, really, really good stuff here, Dan. I wanted to just kind of ask you, for those who are listening today who are intrigued by what you're talking about, maybe they've got new products in development. I mean, geez, 95% of our audience probably at some point is doing new product development. They want to learn more about new product blueprinting. They want to learn more about how AIM Institute might be able to help them. Where would you direct them?
Probably the easiest thing is just to go in www.newproductblueprinting.com, one word. And if they poke around a little bit, they'll see some training plans. And I think this is the cool part. It used to be that we would only do in-person private workshops. You know, it's pretty expensive. You had to get like 20, 30, 40 people in seats and travel costs and all this. But when COVID hit, we had to totally change our mind. We were canceling workshops in Zurich and Atlanta and saying, what's this thing called Zoom?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So now it's kind of interesting. We hold public workshops twice a month. Anybody can come to any of them they want. And then we assign an AIM coach to the new project team right after the workshop. The cost is actually no more on a per person basis. And so if you've got a manufacturer and they've only got three people that want to learn how to do better new product development, those three people come to one of our workshops. We assign a coach. They work on a real project. So they get the benefit of an improved project. Then they have the skills for life. That's our training model these days.
That's a really great model. I love how that works. And yeah, I mean, geez, just the accessibility now of some of these tools, it's just changed everything. I mean, it's very similar to us. Every time we go through a road mapping stage for a client, it's like, all right, let's look on our calendars and let's book flights and fly across the country and take 2 days. Now it's like 4-hour workshop. We'll plan it a few weeks ahead of time and then we can go. And so I love the efficiency. I listen, there's nothing that beats being in a room with somebody, but
sure,
doesn't have to be every time, right?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. Well, Dan, great conversation here. I got a ton of value out of this. You got my brain spinning with all kinds of ideas. So I'm sure our audience is feeling the same way. I appreciate you doing this today.
Well, thanks. I really enjoyed the time here, Joe. Appreciate it.
Awesome. As for the rest of you, I hope to catch you on the next episode of The Manufacturing Executive.
You've been listening to the Manufacturing Executive Podcast. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you'd like to learn more about industrial marketing and sales strategy, you'll find an ever-expanding collection of articles, videos, guides, and tools specifically for B2B manufacturers at gorilla76.com/learn. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.